Clytus, I'm bored. What plaything can you offer me today?
That war rocket Ajax to bring back his body.
Everybody, and welcome to War Rocket Ajax. This is the internet's most destructive comic book and pop culture podcast, and we are your hosts. My name is Chris Sims, and with me, as always, is the big dog, Matt Wilson. Matt, how are you today?
I'm doing great. One versus all, Chris Sims.
Here's the thing. You didn't hear the 20-minute conversation that we just had, so it just sounds like I'm having a stroke trying to introduce Matt. We're all having a lot of fun here.
We were talking about Roman Reigns' many, many nicknames.
But that's not what we're going to talk about today. Matt, what do we do on this show if people are new listeners whose hands have not yet reached the delete button on their internet telephones?
We talk to people who are doing cool stuff in the world of comic books. This week, we're talking to a longtime friend of the show, somebody who's been on the show several times before this. She is promoting yet another Kickstarter for another really cool project about werewolves, and we're going to be talking about that very soon. It's a cool anthology book. Kel McDonald is here. Not only are we going to talk to Kel about Can I Pet Your Werewolf, which is her new anthology project, we're going to be talking about the Werewolf Illuminati and MTV's Teen Wolf, many other wolfy topics.
That's right, Matt. And what is a werewolf if not a big dog?
The big dog?
Just a big dog. Any big dog will do.
Okay. That's true. It does come full circle, even when we don't mean for it to. But Chris, before we talk about some big dogs, we've got some business to take care of, starting with thanking our newest supporters on Patreon.
That's right, Matt. Now, these are the people who have gone over to patreon.com/warrocketajax, and they're kicking in as little as a dollar every month to quite literally help us pay the bills.
We just have one new name to read for the newest supporter that we have on Patreon. It's Travis Creed.
Thank you, Travis. Hey, Travis. Tight name, dude.
Travis, thank you for going to Patreon and helping us out. If you would like to go to Patreon and help us out, all you have to do is go to patreon.com/warrocketajax. And as Chris said, kick in as little as $1 a month to help us keep this show going the way it's been going and help us stay alive and pay our bills and do fun stuff for our Patreon supporters, like bonus audio, like ad-free episodes of the show, like art that we commission only for our Patreon supporters, which we just commissioned a new piece that's coming out soon, like t-shirts, which I just ordered a batch of. That's going to be here soon. We're going to be sending out to people at that level. All kinds of cool stuff is going out to our Patreon patrons, and you can join in on that as well if you feel like doing that. All right, Chris, now that we have thanked our supporters on Patreon, it's time for some checks and wrecks. Chris, what are you checking in with this week?
It's the biggest night of the year for us. It's almost Heroes Con. What this means for you is if you find yourself in the Charlotte, North Carolina area this weekend, you can come see me and Matt selling our comics at a great convention in the Charlotte Convention Center. It's I think it's fair to say both of our favorite conventions this year or every year that we go to. I am vamping for time because I'm trying to find my table number. Matt, what's your table number?
I happen to know my table number. It's AA64, which, if you are familiar with the Nintendo 64, should be pretty easy to remember. I'm going to be tabling with Kevin Warren, the artist of Copernicus Jones, Robot Detective, which issue 8 should be coming out very soon. So we're going to be tabling together. And for the first time ever, we're going to be against the back wall, which I've never been in that area before. So something a little new, a little different, and hopefully it'll work out really well. I think we're in a good placement, and we're not too far from where you are, Chris. I believe you're in the 1600s. I think we're maybe like a row or two away from you.
Chad and I are at 16, 17, and 16, 18. So please come see us. Chad's going to have Young Bloods. We're going to have copies of Deadpool Bad Blood. Army of Darkness, which just came out this past week. Ash vs. Army of Darkness number 0. We'll have Sword Quest number 0s. We'll have X-Men 92s. We'll have Downset Fights. We'll have everything that you want to get from us. And Matt, that back wall section of Heroes Con used to be, I think, a place where you didn't want to get set up. But in recent years, that back wall has turned into something like a pretty good spot, honestly.
Well, luckily, we're not over in the corner. We're kind of in the middle, not too far from the concession stand. So hopefully it'll be a good spot for us. I will, as you probably know, we'll have copies of my brand new book, Supreme Villainy. Kevin and I will be signing Copernicus Jones trade paperbacks. I'll have my other supervillain books and all that stuff, and it should be a great time.
There's one thing that I know about your table placement, Matt, and that is this.
What is
You're
that?
At your best when your back's to the wall. You've been put to the test. And you're taking it all?
When you're right, you're right.
So come to Heroes Con and see us. We're also going to be doing some recording there. We will be doing... I do not know specifics, and we should probably organize them before this weekend. But Greg Schiegel, we are going to be going head-to-head, you, me, and Chad Bowers, in the Challenge of the Super Friends game. And we're going to be recording it for the podcast and putting it out. I think that might just be our annual Heroes Con episode. It's a great show with a lot of great people. A lot of our really good friends are going to be there. And yeah, come to Heroes Con. If you can get there, I promise you it's worth it. It's a great, great convention and a great show. Be there, or try to be there if you can, or be there in spirit. Say nice things about us to empty rooms if you're just sitting in an empty room, if you need to. Matt, it's gotten away from me. What's your check this week?
My check is very similar to my check from last week. My check last week was about the impending release of my new book, Supreme Villainy, and this one is about the recent release of my new book, Supreme Villainy. It has been going great. As of the time that this episode has gone up, I will have done a signing at Comic Envy here in Asheville, and I will have had a release party at Habitat Brewing here in Asheville, and I'm sure they're both going to be great. Thank you to anyone listening to this who came out to either of those. I have more signings coming in the weeks to come. I have a few set up. I'm looking to set up more, so if you have a place in mind, a comic shop or a bookstore that you think would be a cool place for me to come and is maybe within driving distance of where I can get to, let me know. Email me at warrocketpodcast@gmail.com. I am very happy to go out and do signings of these books. I have ordered a ton of copies, so I will have copies that I can take to stores. They won't have to order them themselves. And I'll have copies at conventions that I'll be going to throughout the rest of the year, including Heroes Con. And so far, the response to the book has been great. As we're recording right now, Amazon.com has 9 copies left. So almost all of Amazon's stock is sold, which is great. I'm so happy to see that. It would be amazing if by the time this episode goes out, Amazon was actually sold out of the book. That would be super cool. Also, I want to note that before June 14th, you can enter to win one of 5 free copies of Supreme Villainy through Amazon. I'm not going to give the link to the giveaway on here because after giveaway.amazon.com, it's a long string of letters and numbers. But if you go to my Twitter or if you go to warrocketajax.com, you can find the giveaway link. And all you have to do to enter the giveaway to be entered to win 1 of 5 copies of Supreme Villainy is just tweet. There's a tweet that's auto-generated. You send out that tweet and you are entered in the sweepstakes giveaway. You could win one of those 5 free copies. And I'm not going to say that your odds are terrific, but they're not bad. You have a pretty decent chance of winning that book based on the number of entries so far. If you've already bought a copy, get another copy and give it to a friend. Or give it to your dad for Father's Day. I bet Dad would enjoy it. That's what's been going on with me. I have a lot of excitement and fun around the book release. And it has been today we're recording this on my birthday. It's made this a very interesting birthday to have a new book out as my birthday has been going on. It's given me something to focus on my birthday. Chris, let's make some recommendations. What do you have to recommend?
My recommendation this week is going to be a television show that is very binge-worthy.
Mm-hmm.
I hated every second of saying that. I don't want you to know that. The second season of Supergirl has hit Netflix, and since we became cord cutters, and since the CW app is weirdly, like, only... Like, you can get it on iPads, but not on, like... There's no website to go to. It's very weird. We decided we were going to kind of save up all the CW shows and catch up with them. So we really kind of mainlined Supergirl and the latest season of Jane the Virgin. And Flash is what we're going through now. Supergirl is really, really great. We have watched about half of the second season and watched the second half. You know, once Kevin Sorbo shows up... Not only is it a really good adventure show, and not only does it do a lot of really fun stuff with characters and with the way it treats heroism and the way it presents itself, it's also, like super overtly political in really interesting ways, in a way that I think I really appreciate a Supergirl show being right now. But it's really, really fun and adventurous as well. And we're going to talk about some Tyler's from Teen Wolf later on in the interview portion of the show. But Tyler Hoechlin is an amazing Superman. Have you watched any of the Supergirl episodes that he's been on, Matt?
I have not. Supergirl is one of those shows I really need to catch up on. I need to just sit down and, as you said, binge all I can of the show. And I'm hoping to get around to that when not all my time is taken up with house stuff and book stuff, which,
yeah,
keep your fingers crossed that that's soon.
If you haven't checked out Supergirl, it's not the, like, weirdly heavy, drawn from DC continuity show that I think Flash is or Legends of Tomorrow. But it is certainly a really fun show that does a lot of fun things that you want to see from Superman, that I certainly want to see from Superman and associated characters. And one of the things that I really like about it is the first season, when it was on, what was it, on CBS, I guess? It's like, part of the premise of the show was that Superman is the only superhero in the world. Like, to the point where they talk about, in those early episodes, they're like, there's a female hero? Like, it's a completely revolutionary concept that there would even be, like, a superheroine. That doesn't really go away. It's on the CW, and they do, like, some crossovers with Flash and with Legends, but those are, like, interdimensional crossovers. Like, they take place in different dimensions. But they do that thing where, you know how in Buffy, eventually it's just like, oh yeah, here's the demon bar where all the demons hang out, and they got demon stuff going on? It does that, but with aliens. So there's, like, a bar in National City where just aliens hang out, and everyone is completely aware of this. And it does not take long for Supergirl to get to that point, and I think it's a really fun aspect of the show. But yeah, check out Supergirl Season 2. It's on Netflix. It's absolutely worth watching, and hits those Superman buttons and superheroism buttons that I think the Superman movies often lack. And Tyler Hoechlin is a great Superman. Matt, what's your rec?
My rec is a podcast, and it's about professional wrestling, one of our favorite things to talk about. It's called Tights and Fights. It is a podcast hosted by Hal Lublin, Daniel Radford, and Mike Eagle, sometimes known as Open Mike Eagle, who is also a musician. And occasionally they have on other hosts. Lindsay Kelk, I think, is the one who is most often on every few episodes. But it's just a really good wrestling discussion podcast. Every week they get on and they talk about you know, that week's pay-per-view or just Raw and SmackDown. And occasionally they talk about, like, New Japan and how they don't have a ton of time to watch it, but they watch it when they can. They're all funny. They're all comedians of one type or another. But it's really a pretty serious discussion of that week in pro wrestling. And I don't know if I've talked about this a lot on the show, but one of the reasons I got back into pro wrestling a few years ago after being out of it for several years, almost a decade, was one, partially because Chris, your enthusiasm for it and you talking about it on the show and me sort of having proximity to that made me interested again. And I wanted to know what you were talking about. And when you were telling me that NXT had a Craven the Hunter, I had to kind of see what that was about. But beyond that, it was also coming to realize that there was this whole world of smart, well thought out and diverse wrestling commentary out there on the internet. Like people who weren't just Dave Meltzer writing or talking about wrestling from a perspective that is not one that I'm used to. Tights and Fights is really good in that regard of being a wrestling podcast that brings those different perspectives and has a diverse group of people talking about an old form of entertainment that has often dealt with cultural diversity in reductive ways, let's say. So,
it's a very charitable way to put that, Matt. I'm very impressed.
I'm being diplomatic, but it is great to hear from folks like that and from folks like Ellen Megan on Hard Times and some of the other people out there doing commentary about pro wrestling, what they think about the Jinder Mahal story that's going on right now. So I've really enjoyed listening to Tights and Fights. It has entered my podcast rotation. And if you're looking for a wrestling podcast to listen to, you should consider that one. All right, Chris, those are our recommendations. It's time for us to talk about some comics. Where do you want to start? Do you want to start with talking about the first issue of the new Magnus series?
Yeah, let's do that. Matt, are you familiar with Magnus as a character?
I've never read a ton of the old Magnus comics. I think I maybe have read an issue or two of Valiant Comics Magnus.
I have a run of the, I guess, the kind of Acclaim Comics version of Magnus. Because it's by like Mark Waid and Tom Pyre. But I've never actually sat down and read it. But I only know Magnus really from reputation. And that reputation is that he's a dude who karate chops robots. And that's literally all he does. It's in the name of the book. He's a robot fighter.
And what's wild about Magnus, the character, is how, I think we're pretty quick to think of Valiant Comics and Acclaim Comics from the 90s, but that character's been around since the 60s.
Yeah. He was one of those Gold Key characters like Solar and Turok.
There's a long history of Magnus Robot Fighter, and there are a lot of different interpretations of that character as well. I don't think there's one as different as this one, though, in this series by Kyle Higgins and Jorge Fornes, which not only reimagines Magnus as a woman, a female character, but drops the robot fighter from the name.
Yes, which it makes sense because, Matt, I don't know if you were keeping a running tally of how many robots got karate chopped in this book, but I certainly was. That's how I approached it. And that number is zero.
Yes. Weirdly enough, I found it to be very similar to the Valiant relaunch of Dr. Mirage,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, it's taking what was a male character in previous incarnations and making them a woman, and at this, and also making them a character more inclined to fix than break. Because what Magnus does in this book is she's basically a robot therapist.
Yeah, I think they specifically call her a robot psychologist, which is very interesting. And the idea, the premise of the book, artificial intelligence has gotten to the point where we have, like, sentient robots that are only used for, like, labor. But in their downtime, they basically go into the Matrix, right? Like, they have a robot world that exists into the cloud where they go and upload their consciousness and have, like, lives there. And so what they want is freedom, but they want freedom from humanity, which is really a really interesting take on robots. It's not something I feel like I've seen before, which is always a plus.
But also, it's not just a softening of Magnus the character, because something we come to find out when Magnus gets called in by sort of the, I don't know, this world's version of robot enforcement, basically, is that even though she's a therapist now, she used to have a much more destructive past. It's a lot like Blade Runner. She's called in almost to be that character that retires robots again, because the first thing that happens in this book is a robot that is basically abused in its job ends up killing its employer, and that's when Magnus is called in to do some tougher work. I really like that setup.
The first thing that happens in this book is you see a robot kill some people, and you're like, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, you can't really blame the robot because the people are so terrible.
Yeah, they're so really shitty.
Way out there terrible.
I think, honestly, I would have preferred a little more action here at the front, but I understand why there isn't. I understand, like, why this book wants to do it this way, if for no other reason than to distance itself from the idea of Magnus Robot Fighter by being at the start of things something very different.
Yeah, I would say if I had one complaint, it would be that this feels more like a zero issue than a number one.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It feels like prelude to when the action's going to start.
Yeah.
And it's rather talky. However, I do like the setup of Magnus as a nonviolent character at the beginning. So when I would suspect we inevitably do see her have to come to some kind of violence or make martial decisions, it will have more of an impact.
Yeah, I think you're, I don't think you're wrong about that. But I feel like it's one of those books that ends, you know, spoiler warning, but this book ends with Magnus going into the world in the cloud. And it's one of those where it's, oh, it's the first issue, but it's just getting good. Like, it's just getting to the thing that I really want to see. So I absolutely want to read the next issue. And I should say, this is put out by Dynamite, which is the company that's also putting out Sword Quest and Ash vs. Army of Darkness. So just a quick disclosure there for everybody.
Yes, disclosure, disclaimer. Up next, let's talk about Batman number 24.
When I caught up on Tom King's run on Batman with David Finch and Mikael Janin, one of the things I talked about was the most interesting stuff in that book is the way he presents his relationship, the way he does his take on Catwoman and Batman's relationship. I think that really comes to a head in this issue in a way that is certainly surprising. Despite my tone of voice, I don't mean that in a bad way. But it's a thing where it's one of those things where you know it's not going to end the way it's way it's going. When this series started, you kind of correctly pointed out, like, you know, you were like, oh, Gotham is going to die. Gotham Girl is going to stick around. And this entire run has been about Gotham Girl and kind of figuring out how to deal with her as a character. Like, you know, the first arc of kind of figuring out her powers and how she works and in relation to Gotham. The second arc being like, you know, going to get the Psycho Pirate to fix her because she's been sort of broken psychologically by the Psycho Pirate. And then moving on into this one. And the point of this issue becomes her asking Batman what he wants. And it's really interesting because, you know, we talked about how at the end of The Button, like, I'm not a huge fan of Batman stories where Batman decides not to be Batman, right?
Yeah.
And we don't get that here. We get a Batman story where Batman's like, no, I gotta be Batman. Like, that's what I am. That's you know, I'm Batman because I'm Batman. That's what's up. The way that it dovetails with Catwoman and the way that Catwoman's been presented in this book is really interesting stuff.
I'm a little wary of, like, Batman-Catwoman romance stories, to be honest.
I think if they're done well, they can be really entertaining. I think this has the potential. It's King and Finch and the other artists really kind of walking a razor's edge of, is this just going to be like a short-term, like, last page reveal, or is this going to become something more meaningful at the end of the day? And I want it to be a good story more than anything else, and because, you know, I like Tom King.
Finally, I'm going to talk just briefly about the new Iceman number one, which is written by, is it Cena or Sina?
John Cena, Matt.
Okay, but what about Cena Grace? Is it Cena or Sina?
I believe it's Cena Grace, yes.
Cena Grace. With art by Alessandro Vitti. You know, people who have listened to our panel president segments know that Bobby is not our favorite X-Man. Of the original five, he might be number four.
He's certainly above Warren, I think.
Yeah.
But not, like, he doesn't, I don't think he beats Gene Scott or Hank.
Yeah. However, this first issue of this solo series for Iceman is the first time in a while that I've read about Bobby Drake and said, hey, I like Bobby Drake. I want to know more about Bobby Drake. And part of it is, you know, this really embraces Bobby's sexuality and how he's coming to terms with it. And we see both the time-displaced teen Bobby Drake and the, you know, original adult Bobby Drake and how they're both working through stuff with their sexuality and stuff with adjusting to having come out in different ways. And I really like the narrative structure of this issue because it's all structured around the adult Bobby creating a dating profile. And so a lot of the captions, a lot of the narration is Bobby writing his dating profile as we're seeing him, like, practice in the danger room with the other younger Bobby. And as we're seeing him, you know, go about his day and interact with the other X-Men and fight bad guys who are hunting down mutants, and how he's kind of using his old tricks on them, like making a decoy of himself and that kind of stuff. And by the end of the issue, he decides to totally change his dating profile completely and makes it something totally different. And so the last caption we see is his new dating profile. I just think that's really clever. I think Cena Grace did just a really good job of getting inside Iceman's head and making Iceman relatable and enjoyable to read in a way that he isn't always. I was really impressed with this first issue, and I think it's one people should give a try. Like, if I was going to rank Iceman on Panel President now, I might put him a few spots higher just based on this issue alone. It does a lot for the character. It's really good.
And with that, I think we've wrapped up our comics review segment, and I think it might be time to talk to our good friend Kel McDonald about Can I Pet Your Werewolf? her Kickstarter project.
Let's talk to Kel.
Joining us for the program today, we are pleased as punch to welcome back a friend of the show. You may know her from Sorcery 101, from Misfits of Avalon, from her appearances on this show, and on Xena Business as well. Our good friend Kel McDonald is back to talk to us about werewolves. Kel, welcome back.
Hi.
I feel like you are a person who has no shortage of opportunity to talk about werewolves.
I talk about werewolves a lot. That's like, I think that that is something that I come back to on a regular basis.
If I had to have a particular famous monster that I was partial to, it would obviously be vampires. Specifically, it's Dracula, but it would obviously be vampires.
Yeah. You're a Dracula fan.
So my question to you is, why werewolves? What do you like about werewolves, Kel?
I just think they're neat. I feel like the lore is more varied, because before starting Sorcery 101, I did a lot of digging and, like, old-school myths and stuff. And it's also one that I feel like hasn't been as explored by media as much. Like, when we see werewolves in movies, we kind of get the same thing over and over again. And partly that is because what we know about vampires as, like, the mass public comes from Dracula, which was written in the late 1800s. But what we know about werewolves as a mass public all comes from the 1930s Wolfman movie. And because of that, we haven't, like, dug very deep, because it's fairly new in, like, the pop culture zeitgeist.
Like, why do you think that is? Because werewolves are, like, I mean, they're a folklore thing.
Yeah, but most of the old folklore is not, like, guy that turns into a wolf at the full moon. It is always, like, the first werewolf story is from, like, ancient Greek myth, and it's just, like, Zeus transformed a guy into a wolf as punishment. And he didn't really go back and forth. And then you get later stories are more like this person got the power to turn into a wolf to survive a really bad winter, or you get like God or the devil punished this person. You get a lot of stories like that. You don't really get like the person that goes back and forth. That came from the 1930s Wolfman movie.
It's like all of that. This is not a thing I knew, Kel.
Yeah.
Like the whole thing about transforming back and forth as a werewolf, like,
that is from the 1930s Wolfman movie. Transforming back and forth, it used to be like it was just a person with that power, and it was unconnected to the moon.
Okay. So there were stories of people who would like
change back
be werewolves
and forth
sometimes.
Yeah, well, so it would be like a story where, like, this is a bad winter happened, and then to survive, this village got the power to turn into wolves because it was easier to find food as a wolf than as a person. And then, like, spring would come and they'd turn back into people. And stuff like that.
Is it easier to find food as a wolf than as a person?
Well, if you think about it, in medieval times, if
the
you're
restaurant
farm
at Myrtle Beach.
Yeah. Well, like, if you are in a post-industrial, a pre-industrial society, and you gotta rely on farming, and, like, something bad happened to your crops, you then have to rely on hunting, which is easier to do as a wolf than as a person who maybe doesn't have a lot of weapons and wasn't prepared to spend all winter hunting.
Okay, that makes sense. I just feel like thumbs are a big advantage, Kel, I gotta say.
Yeah, no, but like these are written in like the 1200s, so
you, You're right. Wolves used to have thumbs, I think, is what I'm learning.
Yeah, clearly. But yeah, so the full moon getting added to werewolf stories, silver getting added to werewolf stories, that's all from the 1930s Wolfman movie.
And the silver stuff, like, really, like, comes from vampires, right?
Yeah. And actually, it used to be, if you killed a werewolf but didn't dispose of the body properly, they would come back as a vampire.
One of the things that I've been fascinated by is the idea of the Chinese hopping vampires.
Uh-huh.
And how they're basically zombies, but, like, if they stick around long enough, they get more powerful and become vampires.
Right.
And I kind of love that, because it's like, it makes it not necessarily, like, a curse or a supernatural affliction as much as it's a career path.
Yeah.
And I kind of like that idea.
Right. So it used to be stories like someone would get their wolf transforming power and then they'd get killed and then they'd come back as a vampire.
So all of this leads to your newest project, which is called Can I Pet Your Werewolf?
Right.
Kel, I wanted to ask real quick, because we had Katie Schenkel on the show recently. And she brought to our attention Werewolf News.
Yes, I've met that guy.
Well, have you talked to him?
I'm so happy right now.
I want to note that Can I Pet Your Werewolf has been featured on Werewolf News in a post.
Yes, it has.
And
he's also written about Better to Find You With, which is a werewolf book I did on my own. And that was the last time I was on the show, I was promoting that.
Two, have you pitched to the proprietor of Werewolf News a column about werewolf lore, which you are clearly very knowledgeable about?
I don't really have time to write about werewolf lore.
Hey, Matt, if they're hiring, let me know first, okay?
Okay. I will say that more than just a Quentin, who seems to be the operator of Werewolf News, there are bylines by other people. So that Werewolf lore column could be in the works. Something
the column where I literally just call Kel and Benito,
yeah,
and record the phone call and then write it up and present it as though it's my own work. Well, it occurs to me, we did just recently have Katie Schenkel on to talk about Moonlighters. As someone who is working within the field of werewolfery,
yes,
are you finding that there is a particular, like, werewolf zeitgeist happening right now?
So I feel like there are a lot more people finding each other because of the internet. But okay. So this is also part of, I was mentioned that, like, werewolves have not had time to fully properly, like, be thought about in culture as much as vampires. And now I think we're starting to get the point where people are starting to be like, wait, this thing is odd, or let's push it in this angle more. So we are getting more variety of things. Because, like, if you looked for werewolf books 10 years ago, you'd get, like, two types of stories. You get the ones that are, like, really gory horror stuff that's focusing on how much blood and guts can we get in this movie. Or you're getting something along the lines of, like, a romance novel, but there's really creepy and uncomfortable, like, behavior that is justified because the person is like, 'cause wolves. So it's like they have, like, alpha male who's really controlling, and he's like, but he's just, it's 'cause of his wolf nature that he has to stalk you and control what you do. Sort of. They're using the werewolfness to justify really abusive traits.
And so you're seeing, are you seeing more variety, more people who are
like, I like werewolves, and I like to dig deeper into, like, behavior and stuff, but this creepy alpha male sexist controlling behavior is not what I want from a werewolf story that is not a horror story.
Okay. The reason I bring this up is because what you're like, Can I Pet Your Werewolf is an anthology. You've got a lot of different creative teams involved, including some friends of ours. Rashad Doucette is someone that that I've known for a long time, who's a phenomenally talented artist, and I'm super stoked to see what he's going to do with some werewolf stories. But I wondered, what did you tell them? Were you just like, hey, whatever a werewolf is to you, do a story about that?
Or were there, like, specific werewolves? I did specify I want stories that are cute, goofy, sweet, or bittersweet. And then I specifically said, I do not want angst unless it is a joke about said angst. I do not want a lot of gore unless, again, it is a joke. And then I said, and I do not want werewolves used to justify abusive, shitty gender roles.
Which makes sense, like, given the title and, like, given the people involved. Like, you've got a Meredith McLaren story in here. That looks to fit that the kind of very cute angle that you're going for.
Yeah, and so I then sent people two links of examples of the type of stories that I'm looking for. One is called The Cage, which is about a lesbian couple trying to raise a baby werewolf. And that's a prose short story that was on tour. And then I sent them, for a goofy example, a comic by Sloan Long called Alpha Princess Guru Sojo, which is like Sojo manga stereotypes, but through like wolf furries. So they'd be like talking about boy problems and then be like, but I gotta mark this tree, hold on.
That sounds delightful.
Yeah.
So what has the, response been from, what's the response been in general? Like, not just from, like, werewolf news and werewolf people. Do you find people are, like, excited about seeing new takes on this stuff?
I think I'm getting also a lot of people that really liked MTV's Teen Wolf. Because Teen Wolf kind of tapped into that and got people that were interested in more, like, softer, goofier werewolves, because that's all about, like, cute teenage boys goofing around with each other.
Well, I was going to ask you if you were planning on setting up a HowlerCon this year.
Oh, no. No, I am not. I've never been to HowlerCon.
Oh, HowlerCon, I hear that is the place to go.
But one of the artists in Can I Pet Your Werewolf used to do, like, animated summaries for MTV of episodes of Teen Wolf.
Wait, for MTV?
Yeah, like, they would be on the official MTV website, and they would explain what happened in the episode, and she would, like, draw cute, goofy versions of all the characters. That's Kendra Wells. That's how I found her art, is that she's doing these animated recaps of Teen Wolf.
Is that KendraCanDraw on Twitter?
Yes.
That I have seen her stuff before. She's really fantastic.
Yeah.
I'm gonna blow up somebody's spot. Chad went to HowlerCon a couple years ago.
Uh-huh.
And he said,
Chris, that would be your co-writer, Chad Bowers.
That would be Chad Bowers, writer of Youngblood. For Image Comics.
If there's one thing we gotta start doing, we can't just refer to people we know by their first name. We have to start saying who they are.
If I'm talking about a Chad, it's always gonna be that Chad.
But there are people who have never listened to the show before.
We have the werewolf audience.
Let's have this discussion off mic. But anyway, Chad Bowers, your co-writer.
Okay, so there was a panel that he attended, because he and his wife went up, because Chad Bowers' wife was a big Teen Wolf fan, and he told me that there was a panel, and he said it was the best panel question he'd ever seen, because someone got up in the panel and said, like, I don't know if there's a Tyler on the show, but it seems like a show that there would be a Tyler on.
There is a Tyler. Tyler is the main character.
Is he the Tyler who became Superman?
No, that is a different Tyler. There are two Tylers on the show.
So the way it was pitched to me is someone in the crowd says, yeah, I have a question for Tyler, and it's a two-part question. The first part is, what's your favorite club song? And the second part is, can you take your shirt off? And I'm like, that never happens at the panels I am on, and I want it to. Like, I want to do a War Rocket Ajax panel where someone's like, this question's from Matt Wilson.
I don't know if you've seen Teen Wolf, Chris and Matt.
Not a moment of it.
Apparently, in MTV's Teen Wolf, when you become a Teen Wolf, you forget how buttons work. So...
Now, when did that enter the lore, Kel?
With MTV's Teen Wolf. They were like, what if all these werewolf boys just never button their shirts?
Do you have in Can I Pet Your Werewolf? Is there any shirt buttoning instructions that you had to give to contributors?
No. No, that is not a thing that happened.
Okay. Just wanted to make sure. Just wanted to see. Obviously, we've talked about how you enjoy the werewolf lore, you enjoy the nature of werewolf stories, but I think there is one motivation that you're being a little cagey about, Hill.
What?
You are, I'm sure, colluding with the werewolf Illuminati.
I'm not colluding with the werewolf Illuminati. Is this our segue into the werewolf Illuminati?
This is our segue into this, because... one of the things that we were hanging out at Emerald City, and one of the things that we did was we started talking about some of the weirdest stuff that's happened to us at conventions, which is like always, you know, we've all been at this for years, you, me, and Matt.
Yeah.
And you had, I think, one of the best stories of strange things happening at the table.
One San Diego, I was tabling next to a woman who had a comic that you couldn't quite tell what it was when you looked at her banner. But then she'd hand people a flyer as they walked by and said, it's like the Da Vinci Code, but it's real.
Which is an amazing sales pitch, like two stars.
And then, as you talk to her, you realize it is not a sales pitch. In her mind, her comic is nonfiction and is informing you of the dangers of the werewolf Illuminati. Because you see, there are secret messages in all Renaissance paintings that are warning the general public about the secret werewolves that control everything. And her, like, banner behind her, if you stuck around after those first two parts, she would then turn to the banner behind her, which was a Renaissance painting that was then flipped over itself at, like, a 50% opacity, so it was making a bunch of diamonds and triangles. And so she said, this is an example of how you crack the code. You see, I have taken this painting and it reveals that this lady has wolf ears and she is holding a chalice of blood. She then talks about how there are secret messages in the Declaration of Independence that are also warning us about the werewolves. And that the book Dracula is really to warn us about the werewolves, and he used vampires instead, because if he had used werewolves, then the werewolf Illuminati would be on to him. And the same is also true of Lord of the Rings and H.P. Lovecraft.
And all that checks out, I think.
And she would then hand you a flyer that would explain all this in detail. And then she talked about how Wiccans worship Satan, and they're empowered by the werewolf Illuminati. And there's a lot of stuff that, like, I would have to... If you had warned me like earlier in the day, I could have found, because I typed this all up and posted it in a Facebook post. Like, I listened to her talk her pitch through and like typed the whole thing up because I was like, I need to show this to everyone that I know. And I could have found that post earlier in the day and had it ready to pull up. So people would hear this crazy woman who really believes the werewolf Illuminati is out there and that she is chosen by God to tell everyone about it. When people would be like, so this is the premise of your book? She's like, no, this is real. She's very adamant that it is real. So people would hear all of her mess, and then my table would be the next table that you would approach. And then I would then have to attempt to sell a werewolf comic to someone who just listened to this woman rave about secret werewolves controlling everything. Needless to say, that is the worst sales I've ever done at a convention.
That has to be the weirdest experience at a con. If only because, like, you're doing the comic, like, you're doing the fiction version, yes, of that. I cannot imagine believing in anything strongly enough to table at San Diego, to be honest with you.
No, San Diego is so expensive. This woman must have spent at least $3,000 to tell everyone about the werewolf Illuminati.
I mean, a lot of things are falling into place for me now. Like, a lot of things that I was confused about, like, I'm understanding it. Like, clearly she felt this message was so important that it was worth the expense.
Yeah.
And I think I get it.
Well, Matt, spent years studying the Declaration of Independence.
I mean, I've been parsing every word, so I got a lot to think about, is all I have to say.
Kel, do you remember any of the specifics on that one? Like, what is in the Declaration of Independence that's like,
She just said that, like, Thomas Jefferson wanted to give us clues on how to crack the code, and that's all she would explain.
Well, I mean, it is true that Thomas Jefferson was a devil worshiper who raised the demon Barbatos in a satanic ceremony in Gotham City. But, clearly. I mean, yeah, like, that doesn't get talked about as much as it should, I think. So is she not in the anthology?
She is not in the anthology because she thinks werewolves are trying to take over the world. She wouldn't support this anthology.
Was there any, like, tension where you were, like, where you would be called upon to be, like, you know, so you'd be like, okay, so what's your book about? And you'd be like, well, it's about werewolves. And she'd be like, that's not something you need to be joking about.
No, I don't think she could hear what my pitch was.
Were you delivering your sales pitch at like an ultrasonic level that's only audible to wolves?
Well, the thing is when she was telling her pitch, she was kind of shouting it, and that's why I could hear it. Because it was like, there was like her table and then a 3-foot like break for people to leave their tables. And I was intentionally not facing her.
I think I may have asked you this question when we talked about it before. What was she selling?
She wasn't selling anything. She was just handing out flyers.
That's again. So much money.
Yeah, that's why it's like, if you wanted to just hand out flyers, you could have done that by standing outside San Diego and not spent as much money. But I guess she needed a place to display her banner so she could point to it to point out, like, the chalice of blood.
The restraint you have shown in not just incorporating all of this into your next comic is, I think, admirable. I don't think it's a thing I would be able to resist. If I was, like, already doing comics about the supernatural, and then somebody rolled up on me talking about the werewolf Illuminati, like, I would have left the convention center, found a Best Buy, bought a digital recorder, and just slid it across the floor.
Well, see, that is why I wrote it all down because I needed to show it to every single one of my friends that collects train wreck people. Obviously, I wanted to have it for reference for situations like this when people are like, tell me about the werewolf Illuminati.
So you've got Can I Pet Your Werewolf, which is on Kickstarter now, with some fantastic talented artists involved. You're also doing a bunch of Buffy stuff for Dark Horse of late.
Yes.
Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, it's Buffy the High School Years. They're like lost episodes from Buffy Season 1. So unfortunately, Oz is not in it, so I can't werewolf it up.
Seems like another cruel trick played by the Werewolf Illuminati to me, but what do I know?
Yeah, clearly. But so the one that comes, one is already out, and that is called Glutton for Punishment, and that came out in October, and that is like Buffy and Xander take a home ec class, and there is a demon that is stealing chefs in Sunnydale. And because Xander cheats in class, the demon kidnaps him. And so this one is about, there is a demon that looks like a small child that brainwashes sentient beings into taking care of it at the expense of their own health. And it casts a spell on Buffy's mom.
Yeah, and that one's out in stores now. And I read that today. And it's, if you are a fan of Buffy, and I did some recent rewatching of a couple episodes of Buffy when it had its big 20th anniversary, not too long ago, I guess a couple months ago now. This particular issue with the demon that demands you take care of it has, like, captures the tone of that show so perfectly, because it also, like, it has, it literally has the supernatural thing, and then the supernatural thing is a metaphor for,
yes,
in a way that I think is super appealing and, like, really,
that is why
fits
I love
with
Buffy.
The show and the way it works.
That is why I love Buffy and kind of strive to capture it. Then I wrote a free comic book day short story for Buffy. Chris,
is that still available anywhere?
I don't know. Where do free comic book day stories go when it's no longer free comic book day?
I mean, sometimes they wind up on, like, Comixology.
I don't know. I don't know where you can get that one. Sorry.
It's probably on Comixology somewhere, yeah. I think.
Go to your local shop and demand that they give you free comics today. Tell them to live every day like it's free comic book day.
That one has a joke that I'm very proud of. There's a vampire in it who's mad that his pull box is gone, and he demands, he's mad at the owner for getting rid of it, and he's like, why'd you get rid of my pull list? Well, you died.
As someone who worked in a comic book store for 6 years, I can confirm that, like, if we had gotten news that someone had died, it would be months before we got around to canceling that subscription. Well, Kel, I am super excited to see that you've got so much really great stuff going on, and I cannot wait to read Can I Pet Your Werewolf? What is up of it right now on the Kickstarter page looks so good and so fun, and hearing you talk about it is a genuine treat, because it sounds exactly like the kind of werewolf comic that I would like to read. You know, stuff like Moonlighters, stuff like this. It's really, like, I love fun takes. More than any other kind of monster, I think fun takes on werewolves work really, really well.
Yeah, and it's like,
maybe it's because they're dogs.
It's also because I feel like people haven't super scratched the surface, like I said earlier. Like, I remember when you were talking about Moonlighters, it got brought up, like, why aren't there more feminist takes on werewolves? Because since the monthly cycle clearly connects to periods and stuff. And the reason is because that wasn't added until fairly recently, so we really haven't had anyone, like, dig into what that means other than the obvious, like, period joke. And
it's just Alan Moore.
Yeah, and so that's why I think we're getting, better werewolf stories now, because now people are sort of digging into them.
Well, great. I am glad to see it, and I'm glad that you are a part of it, because your comics are super fun and enjoyable, and you're a person that I trust to make those stories as good as they can be. But now, Kel, it's time for me to start talking about how great your stuff is, and turn the interview over to our listeners on twitter.com to see if they have any questions for you. And Matt, if our listeners want to get in on these fun little chats that we have each and every week, how exactly can they go about that?
Well, Chris, the first thing that they need to do is examine the text of the Declaration of Independence up, down, forwards, and backwards, every way that they possibly can. Read that in every potential way that you can think of to decode the Werewolf Illuminati language. And I don't know why they weren't called the Werluminati, which is right there.
Because they're the Illuminati all the time.
Okay. Learn the secrets of the Werewolf Illuminati, decode it, and then, in a shocking twist, become a member. Join the group. Become a Werewolf Illuminatus yourself. Then, sign up for a very special Werewolf Illuminati verified account on Twitter.com. Follow the Matt D. Wilson, that's me, and the ISB, that's Chris. Wait until Thursday night, perhaps one with a full moon, at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 6:30 Pacific. And one of us will put out the call for questions, just like the questions you're about to hear, for Kel McDonald. And our first question comes from Barely Sushi on Twitter, Mike, who wants to know, what's the proper petting policy on other cryptids, such as Bigfoot, the creature from the Black Lagoon, and so on?
I feel like consent is always important. That's why it's, can I pet your werewolf? Not, I'm going to pet your werewolf.
Fair. Always get that pet consent.
Yeah.
Is it still petting if it's a creature from the Black Lagoon, if it's a Gillman situation?
Can pet those.
Because I feel like petting implies at least not scales.
I mean, you can pet there are pet lizards. There are pet turtles. They are petted.
I guess that's true. If you have a pet turtle, do you pet a turtle? Do turtles enjoy having, like, their shells touched?
I don't know. I don't have a turtle. Write in.
WarRocketPodcast@gmail.com. Tell me if you pet turtles.
I don't think it's the shell. When their head comes out, you kind of just, like, you know, move your finger back and forth on top.
Matt, I'm going to ask you a quick question. Do you understand the image that is in my head when I think of the word turtle?
Like a Ninja Turtle?
You got it. It's Michelangelo.
I'm sure that Michelangelo would like to be petted.
He is a party dude. So
yeah.
He sure is. The next question comes from @trivia_lad, Tim Maytom on Twitter, who wants to know, this is a question for everyone, what's the best non-wolf were creature?
Kel, do you have one in mind?
I like werebears, because it's fun to say werebear.
It rhymes.
Yeah.
It is pretty fun to say werebear. That is true. Matt, do you have one?
I mean, I like that were-terrier. For my zombie.
Yeah. Yeah, like, he's the kind of the one I was thinking of, too, but that's, like, really just werewolf adjace.
Yeah. There's a lot of good werecat things.
I'll tell you who I don't like is that werecat from Batman the Animated Series. Tigress? Yeah. Not a fan of Tigress.
But he's not really a werecat. He's just a furry.
Not one of the better episodes of Batman the Animated Series.
No.
Most certainly not. I don't know, like, what were options are available? I know were rats are a big thing in D&D, but who cares?
I hear a lot about mammals. I read a really good book that had a were pony in it. It's a book called The Utterly Uninteresting Adventures of Fred the Vampire Accountant. And one of the other main characters is a, like, big burly trucker guy that turns into a pony.
Is Turbo Teen, like, a wear car?
He is. He would be a wear car.
I would say like a wear car, then.
All right. Let me give kudos to the author of the Vampire Accountant book for advertising it as uninteresting. That is a gutsy move.
It's a very funny book. I recommend that you check it out.
Okay. Next up, we have a question from Stone Cold HCC, an account that exists only to ask questions on War Rocket Ajax. And Stone Cold asks, "You think it'd be real hard to carve my face into the side of a mountain?"
Yeah.
I think it depends on the tools you have.
I think regardless, I guess it depends on how long. Like, we're thinking, like, Mount Rushmore size, but if he just wants to, like, make a actual size Stone Cold HCC face on the side of a mountain, like, you could probably do that, like, fairly easily.
That's still a lot of work, though.
Well, it also depends on how detailed you want to make it. I mean, yeah.
Either way, you're carving stone. That's hard.
That is hard, yes. James Fletcher at Discord_Inc. on Twitter wants to know, what's the floofiest dog you've ever seen?
Have you ever seen a Caucasian mountain dog? They are the floofiest dogs I have ever seen. They're ginormous. They're also incredibly vicious, but they are the floofiest dogs on the planet.
They are some big floofy boys. I just
Googled them.
I just Googled them up, yep. Big floofy dogs.
Yeah, that can murder you. They're basically bears.
I will note that at Xavier Files also asked what where animal is our favorite. Trey Lawson at T_Lawson wants to know which are better, werewolves that walk upright, like the Wolfman or Capwolf, or werewolves that are more like big wolves that walk on four legs?
I prefer the big wolf ones. But that's just because I think the ones that walk upright always kind of look samey. Like when people draw them, I feel like people decided on one upright werewolf guy and then just stuck with that.
I have never heard anyone describe something that included Capwolf, which, for those of you who don't know, is that story where Captain America became a werewolf and fought Gable as looking samey.
If you Google...
No, I know what you're getting at.
Other than him having Captain America costume parts on, he looks like a lot of other bipedal werewolves.
Do you think it would be better if all bipedal werewolves wore costumes, preferably the costumes of the superheroes that they are in other stories?
They should 100% do that.
Or maybe they should just be really into cosplay so that you can tell them apart from each other. I will note here that also Juan Ramon Valdivia at Devion1 asked a similar question about preferring werewolves that are regular-looking wolves or man-wolf hybrids.
The other reason why I don't like man-wolf hybrids is because if someone has long hair and they try to incorporate that into the wolf-man hybrid thing, it always looks awful. Like, a werewolf with long hair is always awful-looking. It looks awkward and, like, just bad.
I feel like there's something that I saw where a werewolf had a mullet, and it was glorious.
I disagree with you. I disagree strongly.
Oh, I just found The Werewolf Strikes from an old comic, and boy, does that werewolf have a mullet. Okay, our last Twitter question is from J. Jonah Jameson.
Okay.
At JJJ Bugled News, who wants to know, why do you think petting werewolves is okay? My son is a werewolf, and he's a damn American hero, unlike that menace Spider-Man.
That is, I gotta say, not to interrupt, that is an excellent tweet.
Well, that's why we're asking if it's okay. Again, consent. That's important.
Do you think if you ask John Jameson, werewolf by night?
No, 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 no.
Wait, He's a different werewolf, not Werewolf by Night. Sorry. Yeah,
Jack Russell is Werewolf by Night, my man.
That's right. Is he Man-Wolf?
He's Moon-Wolf, a.k.a. Star God.
Okay. I got my Marvel werewolves confused for a moment.
Look, look, I'm not mad. I'm just saying we'll get letters.
Wait, is he the same son of J. Jonah Jameson that's an astronaut?
Yes, that's him.
Okay. Do they have a story about him being a werewolf on the moon?
That's how he became a werewolf, Kel.
He goes to the moon and he gets a gemstone. He gets possessed by a gemstone that makes him not Moon Wolf, but Man Wolf.
Okay.
It's Man Wolf.
Well, who's Moon Wolf?
I have no idea.
Let's solve this shit right now.
John Jameson is Man Wolf. And not Werewolf by Night. Because I think he's actually werewolf anytime he wants to be. Like, he's a wolf anytime he wants to be because of that gemstone. Anyway, he got that gemstone from the moon. Anyway, Kel, back to my original question. Do you think John Jameson, Man-Wolf, would consent to being petted?
I don't know. I don't know enough about the character since I just asked if he's ever been a werewolf on the moon. I can't make that judgment.
I'm going to say he would, because John Jameson is very kind and friendly character, kind of friendly man.
Do you think he would say, yes, like, several dozen times, but then, like, the 50th person to ask, he'd be kind of irritated with?
He would indulge a lot of people, but he would probably get tired of it eventually.
Yeah.
Quick update, Moonwolf is some guy from X-Men.
Okay, there
apologies
we go.
Apologies all around for the confusion, everybody.
One last question that just came in from I'm in a Swamp, which is a Twitter account that I suggested last week. What type of swamp animal would be the most fun to be a were version of?
I feel like an alligator.
Yeah, a were alligator is the answer.
Yeah.
A gator? If you're talking about a swamp animal, you gotta say a gator?
Because, yeah, I can't think of anything cooler in a swamp than an alligator.
All right. A gator.
A gator.
Kel McDonald, thank you so much for joining us for War Rocket Ajax this week. It's our special birthday blowout episode. We're recording this on my birthday, and your birthday is
in two days.
Before this episode goes up?
Yeah. No, Saturday. So it's
two days before this episode goes up. So send us belated birthday wishes. Kel, where can people do that if they want to do that, and if you wish to be...
I am on Twitter at Kelhound. It's spelt like Hellhound, but with a K. And then I also have... All my comics are on my website, kelmcdonald.com.
Kel, you are fantastic. Everybody should check out Can I Pet Your Werewolf on Kickstarter. Make that book happen, because it's going to be really good. Thank you for joining us.
No problem. Thanks for having me on to promote my Kickstarter.
Anytime, Kel. You're always welcome. You know that.
Thanks.
Thanks once again to Kel McDonald. Back to that Kickstarter. It's going to be good. But now, the time has come for Matt and I to rank some characters. It's time for Panel President.
This is Panel President, the segment where we elect the best comic characters and impeach the worst. Our list this week comes from line stepper Matthew Jackson.
Oh, from the Young Bucks.
Yeah, that's my name.
That is your name.
Matthew's list doesn't have a theme, per se. These are just five characters that he wanted to hear us discuss.
Okay, so no theme. Just some characters.
That's right. The first one, even though there are two that I would say are very similar. The first one on the list is Sue Storm, the Invisible Woman.
I do like the Invisible Woman, Matt. I do like the Invisible Woman. Second best of the FF. Disagree or agree?
I would agree.
Agree or disagree?
I would agree. I would say if we were talking about this in 1975, she would unfortunately be the worst and least memorable member of the Fantastic Four.
Yeah, Invisible Girl era. Like, before she becomes Invisible Woman, which I think is a Byrne thing, to be honest.
There are lots of reasons to find John Byrne problematic. But he did do a lot to make Sue Storm a much more important, much better character.
Sue often doesn't have the problems that I think you run into with other members of the FF, where she's rarely sort of trapped in the same story. Except the Namor thing and the Reed doesn't love his family story. Like, Reed's too much into science, which I hate. I hate that story. But Sue herself, like, the major problem with those is that they are at heart stories about dudes, right? Like, they're stories about Reed, they're stories about Namor. But if you get past those and the temptation to kind of do those over and over that I think, unfortunately, a lot of FF writers and artists go through, Sue is a really adaptable character in a way that I think is really appealing. I think people have figured out new ways for her to do stuff with her powers that have helped, like, reflect interesting things about her character. She's really solid. She has, like, clear-cut motivations. You know, she evolved in time to become not, you know, not just Reed's girlfriend, but, like, to be a member of the team.
Well, the advent of Sue as a scientist in her own right, and the advent of her using her powers to create force fields rather than just turn invisible herself.
Yes.
Those things are what made her a great character, and their evolutions that came later, because the original Invisible Girl was literally like just a woman who turned invisible, and that was her whole deal, and and served as kind of a doormat, to be honest. And
yeah,
in the years since, she's become assertive and there are a lot of different aspects to Sue that are so great. Like, she's incredibly intelligent in her own right. She's a great mom. She's, you know, there is always that story where she's like, Reed, you're working too hard. Come be with your family. But the best Sue stories, you know, paint her as independent. She's got a villain in her that comes out sometimes.
Malice?
I'm talking about Malice. There are a lot of sides to Sue Storm. And for what was such a one-dimensional, or since she was invisible, no-dimensional character at her creation, that's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at that issue where, you know, the FF read their letters and they have a letter about how somebody's like, "Oh, Sue sucks, she's useless," and then their answer is Abraham Lincoln had a mother. The evolution that you get from that to the modern Sue Storm, and I think in Marvel Adventures Fantastic Four, Jeff Parker and Paul Tobin did like a take on that, where instead of being a letter about Sue, it was a letter about Reed. And they did an entire riff on that whole bit that is really great and really gets to the idea of Sue being a much more inherently interesting character, which I think is true. So, yeah, like, the FF power rankings, I think, are Ben, Sue, Reed, Johnny, right?
I think that's right. So we're going to put Sue between The Thing, Ben Grimm, at number 6, and Mr. Fantastic, Reed Richards, at number 53, which is a pretty wide swath.
I don't think she goes above Archie, though. I like Archie. Well, maybe she does go above Archie, because Archie has that same kind of, you know, flatness to him.
You know where I'm looking?
Where are you looking?
I'm looking between. I think Sue goes above the Green Goblin.
Okay.
But below Dr. Octopus.
You do like Dr. Octopus a lot.
I do. Now, no, I think that's it. I think that's the spot.
Unless you have about this.
you have an argument to go higher.
I don't. I think that feels right to me, but I do want to point out that's 7 spots lower than She-Hulk, which I think technically makes She-Hulk the second best member of the Fantastic Four on this list.
I mean, I do love She-Hulk.
So, no, I do. She-Hulk's great.
Mega love She-Hulk.
So the Invisible Woman, Sue Storm, enters the list at number 36.
I will tell you right now, when we get the Incredible Hulk, Bruce Banner, he's going below She-Hulk.
Agreed. Agreed.
Next on Matthew's list is Volstagg.
Talking about Volstagg Valiant?
That's who I'm talking about.
Matt, are you talking about the Lion of Asgard?
That's the dude.
Talking about Volstagg the Voluminous?
He does have considerable volume.
Volstagg, probably in the running for second best Asgardian.
So I was going to ask, is he your favorite of the Warriors 3? I believe that's answered.
In a fucking walk, dude. Like, I like the Warriors 3, and I like the Warriors 3 specifically as a team of 3 guys. But, like, Volstagg's the best. Because the thing about Volstagg is, he's not entirely a blowhard. He's not entirely a coward. He's not, like... He's not gonna fight, you know? He's just a guy who likes to eat and loves his wife and has a bunch of kids. And so he's, you know, like, he adventured when he was a younger man. He's the oldest of the Warriors 3, which I think is a fun thing.
When he has to fight, he can and will.
Yeah. There's right. That amazing P. Craig Russell story that, he plays with the idea of Volstagg not being, you know, Baldur the Brave, not being the bravest of the Asgardians, but when the shit goes down, he turns around and gets his sword out and he says, Volstagg is leaving behind his shield or on it. And it's, like, really good. I love Volstagg, because he's funny, too.
Yeah, he's the funny one. Yeah. Like, Fandral is the swashbuckler.
He's the charming one, the charming man of action.
Yeah, and Hogan is the kind of rough-edged guy.
He's the killer.
And yeah, he's the comic relief. Volstagg is the comic relief of Thor overall, really.
Yeah, and I think, like, that's something you see... That's not a character evolution, either. Like, that's something you see in the Lee and Kirby Thor, and you see it in the Simonson Thor, and you see it in the Mike Emming Thor, and in the P. Craig Russell stories. Like, he has a consistency of character because there's, like, there's nothing to fix with him. He works perfectly in all of those stories. So, yeah, I fucking love Volstagg.
Okay. Where do we put him on the list? Is he better than Dum Dum Dugan?
Oh, yeah, he's better than Dum Dum Dugan. Matt, come on.
Okay. For some reason, that's the first thing I thought of, is, like, Volstagg sort of in the same category as Dum Dum Dugan. But
I think he would go... I mean, I think he goes above Barry Allen. Like, sorry. I think he goes above Barry Allen. I would put him in the neighborhood of, like, a Shane Sexcastle or a Ralph Dibny.
I think I like Ralph more. Is he better or worse than Ray Palmer?
I mean, I think he's better than Ray Palmer. I enjoy reading about him more than I enjoy reading about Ray.
Okay, then let's put him between Ralph Dibny, the Elongated Man, and the Adam Ray Palmer.
So, at number 92, the Lion of Asgard, Volstagg.
Next on Matthew's list, we have Ra's al Ghul.
You talking about the Demon's Head?
I'm talking about Ra's al Ghul.
Uh-huh.
Depending on what you're watching, where people are pronouncing it. Or if you're watching Arrow, they pronounce it every which way.
I have told this story multiple times. I asked a guy who worked as an Arabic translator for the government in, like, 2006. I was like, how do you say this? And he said it was, the English approximation was Ra's. But Denny O'Neill, who created the character, apparently says Ra's. And, like, put that, you know, the long A mark on it. So I'm very conflicted.
Well, I mean, but, Batman the Animated Series is the first place where I heard it pronounced multiple times.
Yeah.
And Batman the Animated Series, it's Ra's al Ghul, full stop.
It is Ra's al Ghul, David Warner, dropping that on you. David Warner, who played three different characters in the Star Trek franchise.
Who was also the Loeb on Freakazoid.
Yeah, David Warner rules, and we do not talk about David Warner enough. That's all I'm saying.
Are you talking about
as a topic?
Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2, The Secret of the Ooze is David Warner?
Yeah, I'm talking about him. I'm talking about the Cardassian who asked Captain Picard how many lights there were, Matt.
That was him.
That is him. Yes.
Okay, so enough about David Warner, though. Let's talk about Ra's al Ghul, the character.
The best villain for that era of Batman and that style of Batman. The world-traveling, post-Roger Moore James Bond Batman could not have had a better villain than Ra's al Ghul.
Ra's is a character that is difficult to do new stories with. Because if you're going to do that Gotham-centric Batman, which is where Batman usually is, a Ra's story is tough. Because even like Batman Begins doesn't quite get it.
Batman Begins, man. Batman Begins did some weird stuff with old Ra's. That's why I think they honestly should have moved past Ra's and stuck with Nyssa as the demon's head. Because Nyssa was a great character, did something new, did not have, like, the inherent enmity towards Batman. But unfortunately, comics are comics, and sometimes they go backwards instead of going forwards. But I do feel like there is a lot you can do with Ra's, and I think people fall into the trap of doing the same thing. I think there's like a theoretically, I think he could work in multiple stories because he runs the League of Assassins, you know? And we're right now even getting like League of Shadows stuff in Detective that I think is an interesting new spin on it.
Yeah, I mean, it's not that you can't go anywhere with Ra's al Ghul, Ra's al Ghul, but it's just hard. Like, I feel like he works in a very particular context, and it's tougher to do stories outside of that context with a specific kind of Batman.
Here's a thing that I think really recommends Ra's. He should be way more problematic than I think he comes off. And this is me saying this as just a, you know, a straight white dude who reads a lot of Batman comics. So I don't have the impression of how like Ra's reflects in popular culture, that you would get from an Arabic reader or someone who was more familiar with, you know, Ra's is meant to be like from kind of Asia Minor or like, you know, the eastern part of the Middle East. So I don't know what it would be like to view him through that perspective. And it's something that I really would like to read on if anyone can point me to someone talking about it. But I feel like he's clearly descended from pulp villains. Like he's clearly descended from Fu Manchu, right? Like there is no getting around it, but he doesn't have the baggage that I think you get with a character like that. Because I think Ra's is always kind of treated with the respect that he, like, demands from the moment that Denny O'Neill and Neil Adams bring him on stage. He's, you know, generally treated pretty well as far as, like, being, like, an interesting character who is not defined by kind of the weird and if we're being honest, orientalist aspects of his character.
Yeah, I mean, his ethnicity is rarely brought up. Like, if his ethnicity does come up, it's not through him, it's through his, like, surrogates and satellites?
Mm-hmm.
Like the... Is it Ubu who keeps calling Batman infidel?
He does call him infidel a lot on that episode of Batman the Animated Series.
Yeah. Anyway, I think we should go ahead and rank Ra's. Where do you think he lands?
I think he's one of the best villains in comics, honestly. I love Ra's. I don't think he's better than Darkseid, but...
Better than Dr. Hurt.
Yeah, I think he's better than Dr. Hurt. I think he's better than Green Goblin. I think he's probably, I would say he's better than Doc Ock, but I don't know. You seem to like Doc Ock a lot.
That's really high. I can live with above Green Goblin.
He just wants to kill 3 billion people.
I can live with above Green Goblin. I can't do above Doc Ock.
Okay, so between Sue Storm and Norman Osborn goes Ra's al Ghul, the Demon's Head, at number 37 on the list.
Now, I said that there were two characters who are kind of similar, and now you know the two. Right after Ra's al Ghul, we have Vandal Savage.
Vandal Savage and Ra's al Ghul should team up, and they don't.
I think it's because they're too similar, because they're both immortal. Sorta. I mean, Ra's, I guess, is technically not exactly immortal, but he is effectively immortal. And Vandal Savage is full-on immortal, because he was a caveman.
Yeah, which is the thing, though, right? Like, I think they seem similar, but Ra's has the finesse of a 500-year-old. Vandal Savage has the brutality of a caveman. And I think that's a really, really interesting contrast that never gets explored. And I think it's like really, I think the things that distinguish those characters, I find very interesting. And I love how, you know, like Ra's whole deal is like, you can't beat me because I've done what, you know, I've done what Batman did. I spent a lifetime training. The problem is my lifetime is 500 years. So, you know, you're not gonna win this sword fight in the desert where we take our shirts off, my guy. Because that's the thing people forget. Batman doesn't win that shortless sword fight. He loses it. Vandal Savage is just going to hammer you until you're gone. He's like, I really like the differences between those characters. I really, like, unsurprisingly, I really like Vandal Savage, too. I think Vandal Savage is great. I think Vandal Savage has unfortunately been tied to Hawkman for a while, but...
Yes. And the big problem, I think, with Vandal Savage is how inconsistently he's characterized.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a version of Vandal Savage that has that caveman ruthlessness and aggression about him. But there's also a version of Vandal Savage that is very civilized. That is, you know, kind of just second-tier Ra's al Ghul.
To a Vandal Civil?
Vandal Civil, that's right. It's... You never know which Vandal Savage you're going to get. In a particular story, he is the type of villain that is sort of cast in whatever role a particular writer needs for a story. And the next time you see him, he might be different. You know, I guess he's identifiably Vandal Savage every time, but he's not. There's just not a consistency to him the way there's a consistency to say a Ra's al Ghul.
I think that's fair. Here's my counterpoint to that. Vandal Savage is the villain of DC 1 Million.
I mean, he is. You're right about that.
Yeah. They don't make him better than that one, Matt.
I mean, it's, that's true.
That's when Vandal Savage teamed up with the Robot Son.
Nonetheless, I'm going to say that Vandal Savage goes below Ra's al Ghul and kind of pretty far below that.
I don't think Vandal Savage cracks the top 100. I don't think Vandal Savage is better than Barry Allen. I will say that. I think he might be better than Hal Jordan, though.
Is he better than Dr. Simon Hurt?
Yes. Talking about two dudes who encounter Barbatos?
All right, here's who is above Dr. Simon Hurt. Lana Lang, Dazzler, Steel, Iron Fist, Hal Jordan. So what you're saying is just between Barry Allen and Hal Jordan?
Actually, looking at those characters, I want to put him just below Lana Lang, just above Dr. Hurt.
Okay, that works for me.
Vandal Savage. Good entrance to the list at number 106. A pretty respectable showing for the world's oldest caveman. Man, he's a fucking caveman.
He sure
That's
is.
That's so great.
Finally on Matthew's list is Carol Danvers. I'm talking about Captain Marvel. Uh-huh. I'm talking about the original Miss Marvel. Uh-huh. I'm talking about Warbird.
Uh-huh.
I'm talking about
I'm waiting for you to miss one.
I'm out now, I think.
You talking about binary?
Binary!
Matt, can I ask you a follow-up question?
Yes.
This is the bonus point follow-up question. Are you talking about the Sentress?
The Sentress. I think I totally... Oh, well, she's from, that's from Age of the Century. She was the Sentress. Yeah. Binary is what she was during the Busiek Perez Avengers run. I should have remembered that.
She wasn't... she was a Warbird then?
She was... I think she became Warbird eventually in that. Anyway.
What a weird name. Anyway, she's Captain Marvel now, and hopefully she stays Captain Marvel forever.
Binary was by far her weirdest code name. Like, Warbird at least makes sense.
Warbird doesn't make sense, but it makes more sense than Binary, which is functionally the same thing.
She used to be a pilot. It's, you know. So, Carol Danvers is great.
Yes.
Carol Danvers is so good. And has such a long history in Marvel Comics and has endured terrible things and still come out on the other side as a great character.
Yeah, if you want to talk about the resilience of a character they could not stop from being great, it is Carol Danvers. Yeah, like I think...
We've talked about Marcus. Marcus is on this list.
Marcus is on this list.
Well, I don't think we need to go into Marcus anymore. She got kicked out of the Avengers for being an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't great. Her powers have been all over the map at different times. She got like irradiated by a Kree weapon. I think that's where her original powers came from, right?
I think that's the original Ms. Marvel origin.
But then she got like Rogue took her powers.
Rogue took her powers and she was in a coma for a while.
Yeah, and then the Brood zapped her with a ray that extracted the natural power in her genes.
Yeah, you know, like when she was out in space with the Akanti, you know, the space whales.
She was in the Starjammers.
She was a Starjammer. Binary was a Starjammer, but here's the thing about Carol Danvers, Matt. She's done everything you can do in Marvel Comics. She's the Chris Jericho of Marvel Comics.
That is a strangely apt comparison.
She's been hanging out with the X-Men. She's been an Avenger. She's been in fucking Alpha Flight. She's been Captain Marvel. She's been not Captain Marvel. She's done it all. She's been in S.H.I.E.L.D. Then she's been not been in S.H.I.E.L.D. And I think that's... I think part of that is because, you know, on a purely like functional level, I think for a long time people didn't know what to do with her. But I think you can get to a point like the point of it is not like character inconsistency. The point of it is that so many people looked at that character and they were like, "We can do something. There's something here," and hopefully Captain Marvel is it. Like, forever.
Yeah.
Because I think she works really well in that role.
It wasn't people not being able to figure out what to do with Carol Danvers. It was saying, this character works, let's do something. And then mm-hmm. that something wasn't always a great idea. Or just wasn't a fit. And now that fit has been found. Here's what I'm going to say. Not as good as She-Hulk. Better than
that's
Black
arguable, but I think She-Hulk has been better longer or been good longer. I guess not even good, you know, because I like Ms. Marvel. But you're saying not as good as She-Hulk, but better than Black Canary.
Yeah,
that puts her above Rogue, interestingly enough. But yeah, I think at number 30 on the list. Unfortunately, Barry Allen is no longer the number 100 spot, so we're going to have to start talking about whether people are better than Hobbs the Tiger. But Captain Marvel, Carol Danvers, goes at number 30 on the list. And I will include, one more time, Binary, Ms. Marvel, Warbird, The Sentress.
All right. If you would like to send us a panel president list, you can do so at our email address, which is warrocketpodcast@gmail.com. That is also where you can send every story ever list. If you have listener questions or if you want to sponsor the show, you can let us know there. Check out our website, which is warrocketajax.com. That is where you can stream the show, download the show, read show notes, and leave comments. It's also where the panel president and every story ever list live. And I will try my best to update those lists very soon. So stay tuned to those lists on the website. If you like the show, go rate us on iTunes. The more 5-star reviews we get on iTunes, the more we are featured. Now we've reached a part of the show where we tell you all the different places you can find us online. For me, all you have to do is go to mattdwilson.net, and you will find links to all my stuff, including Supreme Villainy, my brand new book that just came out, and that I think you'll like. Chris, where can people find your stuff?
People can find everything that I do by going to the-isb.com. You can find links there to things that I'm writing around the web right now, like doing some freelance work for Polygon and for Looper. There are links to those at the-isb.com, as well as links to the comics that I write. Deadpool Bad Blood is out now. Sword Quest is out now. Ash vs. Army of Darkness is out now. And in case I forget, June 28th, all new Guardians of the Galaxy Annual 2017, which is the Secret Empire tie-in. It's really, really fun. Danilo Bayruth and Tamara Bonvillain are the art team on that. Chad and I wrote it, and it's a shockingly beautiful comic. I cannot wait to have it in my hands. But it's really good, and I hope everybody checks it out. Tell your local store that you want it before FOC. So now we've gotten to the point of the show. We have been trying in 2017 to direct our listeners to good causes that they can contribute to. And like we did last week, we asked Kel if she had a cause that she would like us to signal boost and get out there. Kel lives in Portland, Oregon, and understandably wanted us to direct you to the fund for the survivors of the Islamophobic attack on the Max line. Which you can find at youcaring.com/survivors of the Max attack. That's all one word. -833557. That's a little tough to remember, so we will be putting that on warrocketajax.com. But yeah, give what you can. That was a terrible thing that happened. But it is nice to see people coming together in the aftermath of that, if nothing else. So give what you can on that front.
And that's going to do it for this episode of War Rocket Ajax. It was HQC all along.
When the moon is full, Matt, even a good man can become HQC.
We love you.
Yeah! Flash.